Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod.
Famous last words.
I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
You're in Florida, and it's the summer of 1937. You're a young teenage girl, sitting on the floor in front of the family radio. You're listening to music, of course, while drawing, writing, and jotting down the words to your favorite songs in a notebook. Sometimes you even listen to the shortwave radio, the long antenna picking up stations all over the world. Today, you're daydreaming, doodling, and playing with the shortwave radio absentmindedly, searching for something interesting. But one channel gives you pause. It's staticky, and then you hear a woman's voice. The woman sounds upset, panicked, speaking in desperate, articulated English. "This is Amelia Earhart," the voice says. And of course, you listen. Today on Ghost Town, the last words of Amelia Earhart. Amelia May Earhart was born on July 24, 1897, in Atchison, Kansas. From an early age, Amelia and her sister Grace were taught by their mother not to conform to gender norms. They wore bloomers, went sledding, kept bugs and toads, climbed trees, and hunted rats with rifles. At 10, Amelia saw her first airplane at the Iowa State Fair in Des Moines. She described the biplane as, quote, "a thing of rusty wire and wood, and not at all interesting." After many moves following her father's jobs, or lack thereof, Amelia Earhart graduated from Hyde Park High School in 1916. She kept a scrapbook of newspaper clippings about successful women in male-dominated careers, including film and production, law, advertising, management, and mechanical engineering. But when Earhart visited her sister in Toronto, she was moved by wounded soldiers returning from World War I. Instead of going to junior college as planned, Earhart got trained by the Red Cross as a nurse's aide and began working with the Voluntary Aid Detachment at Spadina Military Hospital, making food for patients and handing out medication. It was there that Earhart learned old war stories from military pilots and developed a genuine interest in planes. In 1920, Earhart enrolled in medical studies at Columbia University, but quit to go to Long Beach, California to be with her parents, who had moved there. Together, Earhart and her father attended an aerial meet in Long Beach, and Amelia was hooked. The following day, she booked a 10-minute flight with air racer Frank Hawks at Emory Rogers Field, which at the time was at the corner of Wilshire Boulevard and Fairfax Avenue in Los Angeles. The ride with Hawks changed Earhart's life. She said, quote, "By the time I'd got 200 or 300 feet off the ground, I knew I had to fly." The next month, Earhart hired female flying legend Netta Snook to be her flying instructor. Snook had a lot of amazing firsts to her resume. She was the first woman aviator in Iowa, the first woman student accepted at the Curtis Flying School in Virginia, the first woman aviator to run her own aviation business, and the first woman to run a commercial airfield. Not too bad for an amateur pilot's teacher. Earhart worked all kinds of odd jobs to pay Snook's hefty teaching fees, including being a photographer, truck driver, and stenographer. She saw no other option and fully embodied the pilot life and aesthetic. Earhart cut her hair short in the style of other female flyers of the time, got a brand new aviator jacket that she had to distress to seem cool, and 6 months later, Earhart purchased her own secondhand biplane Airster. Earhart purchased her own secondhand biplane Airster she called the Canary. She was ready. On October 22, 1922, Earhart flew the Airster to an altitude of 14,000 feet, setting a world record for female pilots. And on May 16, 1923, Earhart became the 16th woman in the United States to be issued a pilot's license. But despite setting a record and getting her license, being a pilot wasn't exactly paying the bills. The money was running out, and Earhart was having trouble with her sinuses, a condition she'd had since childhood, and underwent multiple surgeries. She enrolled back at Columbia, but that school was too expensive, so she enrolled at the much cheaper Massachusetts Institute of Technology, you might know as MIT. It was a different time. Staying in Boston, she was a teacher, social worker, and aviation columnist, and became a member of the American Aeronautical Society's Boston chapter, and eventually became its vice president. In the Boston area, Earhart's local celebrity was growing. Inspired by Charles Lindbergh, who had become the first man to fly nonstop solo across the Atlantic the previous year, promoters sought to create a kind of similar stunt based on this historic first, by having a woman fly across the Atlantic Ocean. In April 1928, Earhart was selected for the flight. Some speculated that the decision was partly based on her resemblance to Charles Lindbergh, and I guess I see it in kind of a generic way. In any case, on June 17, 1928, Lady Lindy, as she was called, departed Trepassey, Newfoundland, Canada, the passenger aboard a seaplane piloted by Wilmer Stultz and Lewis Gordon. After landing in Buryport, Wales on June 18th, Earhart became an international celebrity. And I know what you're thinking. She didn't even fly that plane. You're right. She was just sitting in the plane with other pilots. In and of itself, it was a record. In any case, determined to do something with her fame, Earhart crossed the Atlantic alone on May 20th, 1932. Her flight was completed in record time of 14 hours and 56 minutes, despite bad weather, mechanical difficulties, and her inability to land at her scheduled destination, which was Paris. This just solidified her celebrity even more, of course. In 1935, Earhart made history with a first solo flight from Hawaii to California, a dangerous and long route of 2,408 miles. That's 500 miles longer than her 1932 crossing of the Atlantic. She landed successfully in Oakland from Honolulu. Later that year, she also became the first person to fly solo from Los Angeles to Mexico City. In 1937, Earhart designed her most ambitious flight yet, around the world. But she wouldn't do it alone. With acclaimed navigator Fred Noonan, Earhart would take a twin-engine Lockheed Electra for the 29,000-mile journey. Noonan was no slouch himself, by the way. The navigator worked for Pan Am and was widely credited with opening the Pacific to air transportation. On June 1st, 1937, the two departed from Miami, making various refueling stops before reaching Ley, New Guinea on June 29th. At that point, Earhart and Noonan had traveled some 22,000 miles. They were almost there. On July 2nd, they were headed for Howland Island, approximately 2,600 miles away. The flight was expected to be difficult, as the tiny atoll was notoriously hard to locate. But, to help with navigation, two brightly lit U.S. ships were stationed to mark the route. Earhart was also in intermittent radio contact with the Itasca, a U.S. Coast Guard cutter near Howland. So she had many checks and balances, helping her light the way, garner communication with the outside world, etc. But on the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Earhart radioed that the plane was running out of fuel. At 8:43 a.m., the last transmission was received by the Itasca, with Earhart announcing, "We are running north and south." The plane was believed to have gone down 100 miles away from the island, but despite an extensive search undertaken to find the two travelers, on July 19, 1937, the operation was called off, and the pair were declared lost at sea. But what if we had more information, or one last transmission, something else to help us try and solve the enduring mystery of Amelia Earhart's fate? Well, maybe we do. More after this break. Far, far away from Howland Island in St. Petersburg, Florida, Betty Klenk is spending her afternoon listening to a shortwave radio. She comes upon a woman's voice, speaking in English and extremely distressed. Betty was shocked to hear the woman say, "This is Amelia Earhart." Betty herself was always crazy about airplanes and was well aware of Earhart's world flight, so she opened her notebook and started taking notes about what she was hearing. The words came in and out of signal, and really too fast for her to get everything. But out of the distortion and static, she did form a kind of a narrative. Betty heard Earhart's calls for help, but also her comments to a man who was with her. According to a piece in Popular Mechanics about Betty Klenk, she had the distinct impression that the man had sustained a head injury and was delirious. Quote, she gathered that they had crashed on land, but there was also great concern about rising water. The man would alternately struggle with Amelia and try to get the microphone away from her, or panic and try to get out of the airplane. The transmissions continued to come in, off and on. At 5:15, Betty's father came home from work, and she had him listen in. After a few more minutes, her father ran next door to see if his neighbor could also hear it on his radio, but he could not. The transmission stopped entirely around 6:15 p.m. Later that evening, Betty's father reported the event to the local Coast Guard station, but he was told that the government had ships in the area and everything was under control. And that was kind of the end of it. Of course, Betty kept her notebook and over the years occasionally tried to get someone to pay attention to her claims of having heard Amelia Earhart. She had given up thinking that anyone would ever believe her, but a friend sent photos of her notebook to the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, or TIGHAR for short. The International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery reached out, as a housewife in Toronto had also heard a message that day. Her message was, quote, we have taken in water. We can't hold on much longer. Based on their research, TIGHAR believed Amelia Earhart and Noonan crashed into the ocean from lack of fuel, then climbed into her disabled Lockheed Electra. She started the engine, turned on the two-way radio, and sent out pleas for help. The high tide got higher, sucked the plane into deeper water, and eventually cut Earhart and Noonan off from any chance of rescue. Quote, these active versus silent periods and the fact that the message changes on July 5th and starts being worried about water and then is consistently worried about water after that, there's a story there, said TIGHAR director Rick Gillespie. But the two did survive, Gillespie thinks, perhaps spending days on the then uninhabited nearby Gardner Island, trying to survive in the heat and go out onto the plane during low tide. She may have been injured, Noonan was probably worse, and they spent their final days on that island. Gillespie also believed some of Earhart's final messages were heard by members of the military and others looking for Earhart. Still, other of Earhart's messages caught the attention of people who just happened to be listening to their radios in early April. Almost all of those messages were discounted by the U.S. Navy, which concluded that Earhart's plane went down somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, then sank to the seabed. But according to TIGHAR's research, many heard Amelia Earhart's last cries for rescue. Quote, scattered across North America and unknown to each other, each listener was astonished to suddenly hear Amelia Earhart pleading for help. They alerted family members, local authorities, or local newspapers. Some were investigated by government authorities and found to be believable. Others were dismissed at the time and only recognized many years later. Although few in number, the harmonic receptions provide an important glimpse into the desperate scene that played out on the reef at Gardner Island. That's a report from TIGHAR's research, collecting calls, getting information from people throughout many, many years. During all of this, back in the United States, Nina Paxton, an Ashland, Kentucky woman, said that she heard Earhart over the radio on July 3rd say, KHAQQ calling, and says she was, quote, on or near Little Island at Point Near. Quote, then she said something about a storm and that the wind was blowing. We'll have to get out of here, she said at one point. We can't stay long. TIGHAR ultimately identified 120 reports of radio signals believed to be Earhart, and using a system of credibility, the researchers ultimately deemed 57 of the 120 instances to be, in fact, credible. But of course, this is still all just a theory, one corroborated by, you know, just about 57 stories or people. But if you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure you know that there's many theories about Amelia Earhart and what eventually sealed her fate. Some believe she landed on nearby Nukumaroro Island as a castaway, was captured by the Japanese, or even assumed a new identity, more specifically that of a banker named Irene Craigmile Bolam, based on a very confused man at a retired pilot's gathering, thinking that she looked familiar to the woman. Yes, theories about one of the most famed missing persons of our time can really come from anywhere, and everywhere. on online forums, or across radio waves, first as desperate cries for help, and now, static-ridden pieces of history.